The following is a CNA podcast.
Welcome to the Climate Conversations. I'm Jamie Ho. As nations around the world chase the net zero goal, is the quest for renewable energy the silver bullet? The industry no doubt has seen significant change. Costs have fallen dramatically, technology has grown exponentially, and solutions for integrating renewable energy have gathered pace. The question is, how far can renewable energy replace fossil fuels? For example, are there limits to how much solar energy can power different economies? And how ambitious can we get in doing away entirely with the most pollutive of fossil fuels, like coal? With me to talk through this is Francesco La Camera, the Director General of the International Renewable Energy Agency, or IRENA for short. He took office in 2019 and has more than 30 years of experience in the fields of climate, sustainability, and international cooperation. Francesco is calling in from Rome. Welcome.
Thanks to you and for the opportunity.
I'm going to start our conversation by going back to something you said in April after the Leaders Climate Summit, that the door to achieving, as we all know, the 1.5 degree goal by 2050 is still open. But to do that, we need to move away from just pledges and move towards implementation. Tell us what you're looking for in implementation and the role that renewables are going to play in these implementation plans.
When I talk about implementation, it's the possibility for a large part of the world. And in my point of view, the most critical part of the world in achieving the Paris Agreement goal are Africa and the Southeast Asian, as in generally speaking. So it's very important that this part of the world may accelerate the transition. So there are many signals that the transition is there. We see how the demand for fossil fuel is reaching almost in all countries. There are plateaus already, and some countries are already reached. So the demand is going to decline. The new supply, the new demand will be looking at the renewables. So this process is there, is happening faster than foreseen, but still not fast enough. So when I talk about implementation, always I use this expression that we have to accelerate our path, having always in mind that this decade will be decisive in reaching the Paris Agreement goal. So we will know exactly at the end of the decade if we'll be able to be coherent with the Sustainable Development Goals, naturally it's 2030, with the Paris Agreement goal. So implementation means accelerating the path, having in mind that it's not just a substitution of fuels, what we are calling the energy transition, but it's a different way to produce and distribute the energy. And so important that policies may be put in place to make possible investment to come more rapidly, de-risking the investment. So we need a legal environment and policies that may support the formation of the new energy system, so infrastructure, artificial intelligence, all these kind of things. So all these elements have to be considered together when we talk about implementation and moving to the future energy system.
I'm glad you mentioned Africa and Asia as places where you are a bit more optimistic. What are the brightest spots, you think, for you as you look to Asia and especially here for us in Southeast Asia, as far as ability to implement is concerned?
More than say optimistic, is say to be realistic.
Okay, good.
These are the two areas where the energy demand is growing because of the economic growth that is there, and this is much welcome. So what is important that this economic growth may be fit with clean energy and putting in place more decentralized and more connected, interconnected energy system. And in Asia, we have seen many promises, signals. We are seeing that the demand for fossil fuel is reaching the plateau, as I say, in some cases already declining. We have assisted to a big acceleration toward renewable energy, for example, in Vietnam, but also in India, China, all over the Asian region, the progress has been great. So if you look at just the installed capacity of renewables last year, I think 60% of this was coming from Asia. Naturally, China having a major role, but also India is coming fast to have a major role too. And we have seen that, generally speaking, the progress is there. But again, this progress is promising, but it's not enough in terms of space.
I wanted to get your take as well then, as we look to Asia, especially here in the countries that you mentioned, like India, Southeast Asia, what do you think the still ongoing COVID-19 pandemic is doing in terms of our ability to recover and make it a green recovery and sort of entrench some of these energy transitions? Do you think we've taken sort of like a setback, or do you think despite this setback, we can still, in the next year or two, as countries recover in a more green and renewable manner?
ARENA has been working on how to ensure that response to the COVID-19 may be aligned with the medium or long-term objective of the Agenda 2030 and the Paris Agreement. And we publish an agenda on that. So concerning your question, the COVID pandemic is a tragedy and is still having ill impact on our livelihoods and our economies and our societies. At the same time, we have recognized how we are all linked all together. The pandemic is something that we cannot win as a unique country or unique region of the world. We have to win the pandemic together. So this makes sense that the world is only a unite reality. And this applies also to climate change. We cannot win the challenges of the climate change if the world is not working together. So this sense of unity, I think, is emerging strongly after the pandemic. The other aspect that may let us believe that we may align this objective altogether is that we are assisting to the most important intervention of the state into the economy. There are a lot of resources that are there to respond to the devastating impact of the pandemic. This intervention of the state of the economy could be really instrumental to encourage the building of a new energy system. We believe that this is something that may happen. And already in the period of the pandemic, we have seen as the renewables has demonstrated to be more resilient. And a large part, all in all parts of the world, we have been beating record of renewables into the energy system. It is applied in Europe, but all over. We really think that this could be an historic occasion to make the policies, the public intervention, the economy, accelerating the shift to a new energy system, because we have been always clear on this. The move to renewables is just unstoppable. So the question is not where we are going, because we are going inevitably to an energy system that will be based on renewables and complemented by green hydrogen and biomass. What is at stake here is the speed of this move. And the policies and the intervention of the state into the economy are crucial, in my point of view, in this respect.
Those are great points. And I'm going to use what you just said and ask you to give us a sort of a tour of the horizon of where all the various forms of renewables stand right now in terms of the costs. As you mentioned, we've got hydro now, biomass, geothermal, wind, solar. As one looks at the range of these renewables, what's the most optimistic, what's the most encouraging signs that you see in terms of costs? And cost is important because we want to talk about it being more available to the lower income countries, for example.
Naturally, there is a moral imperative to go for a cleaner energy system. But the fact is that there is now also the imperative to go for what is more efficient in terms of cost. ARENA has been publishing a yearly report that is just on costs. And we are monitoring more than 17,000 projects around the world. So it's a very, very good statistical base. And what we see is that renewables, all renewables, are now in the competitive area with the fossil fuels. And in some way, they are now becoming more competitive than the fossil fuels. And sometimes, Jane, what is important to notice is not only more competitive if we compare new plant to be built, a new coal plant or a new renewable plant. There is no comparison between the two. Renewables are much more convenient. And what is happening now is that it's more convenient in our analysis in many areas of the world to build a new renewable energy plant instead to maintain alive all fossil fuel plants, all coal plants. So the operational cost of managing a coal plant are more costly than building a new renewable energy plant. So this is a very important turning point. We are seeing also how the financial markets are moving rapidly, more rapidly toward renewables. We have seen dismission of fossil fuel assets. We have assisting to the fact that many coal plants has been dismissed. Investment in this area are just the stranded asset of the future. So the markets are going in the right direction. So the cost is leading the path to renewables in all ways and means. But again, I wish to end this realistic and in the same time optimistic view with the fact that this is not enough in the sense that this is happening, but has to happen faster if you want to fight the rising of the temperature.
One of the most amazing stories that I love listening to and talking about is, of course, related to solar and how amazingly quickly costs have fallen. Point developing countries, whether you are Vietnam, whether you are India, as you say, are we at the point where they're building a new plant? They should actually be thinking about renewable. They should be thinking about solar, and something like coal really shouldn't be part of the equation anymore from pure cost factors. Are you concerned then, therefore, some of them are still looking at coal?
Naturally, there is concern, and this is obvious because, you know, when we are in a transition, what happened? It happened that we know what we are losing where we are in a transition, and sometimes it's not clear what we are going to achieve. So naturally, any transition maintains a certain kind of perception of risk. What we are trying to do in this respect is working with country, try to make clear how the benefits of the energy transition will be for all. We also encourage governments to consider that there will be many workers moving from one sector to other sectors. So they have to put in place the right policies, the right instrument to ensure that this will happen smoothly and provide for all the fossil fuel workers in some way to look to other new career with a better job, better paid job, in a cleaner environment. So also on this is what is important are our policies. Again, if I can give you more data on showing the trend, last year, 80% of the installed capacity was from renewable. And has been in the last 8 years, the renewable installed capacity has overtaken traditional fossil fuel one. Now there is no really comparison. There is no economic space for fossil fuel in the power sector. Renewables will win always in all circumstances, and most in all circumstances, the competition. So naturally, when we make all these benefits evident, the system will move. Naturally, there will be resistance. It's inevitable. But I think that they will be overcome if the government will come with the right policies. The policies to try to accelerate, to make an environment more ready to absorb more renewables. So in this respect, interconnection, the grid, the flexibility of the grid are very, very important. So these are the priority when we talk about the infrastructure, to making the infrastructure be ready to absorb more renewables and manage the fact that we will have more renewables into the energy system.
Before I transition myself to the next question, I just want to get your last take on the state of solar technology. Have we reached sort of a plateau in terms of what it's able to deliver and therefore the cost factor for developing countries who are looking to deploy it on a mass level? Is this as low as it gets in terms of cost, you think?
Sometimes people thought that the cost of renewables, the decline of cost was going to slow it down, but the fact is not happening. All years we assisted to new records of decreasing cost of renewables. Last year, I think solar, they declined around 7-8%. But we look at wind offshore, onshore, they are 2 digits of decrease. And if you took a concentrated solar power, we have a decline almost close to 20% in 1 year. the cost of renewable are declining and they will continue to decrease.
Besides technology, obviously, there are all sorts of non-technology factors which will determine countries' ability to move towards renewable energy. People know that entire infrastructures are built for fossil fuels, and to change things will need immense political will and some costs, obviously. There will be obstacles, social, political. Do you think people recognize the costs here and the immense political issues that will come about? You mentioned employment is one of them. What's your sense in talking to governments as well in terms of their recognition, whether or not there's political will to take this on?
The political will is there. Naturally, we need to support providing data information to the politicians and taking their own decision. And it's evident, and our report made very clear that investing in renewables is providing more jobs than in fossil fuel. We have a ratio of 1 against 3. For every dollar spent, we have 3 times job creation in the renewable sector than in other. So I think that the social benefits are evident. We also estimate that, globally speaking, in the next 3 years, if we will accelerate the path to the energy transition, we will gain 5.5 million jobs. This is a net number. It's considering the jobs that we are losing and the job that we are creating. So the net added job are 5.5 million. That is an impressive number. And this will continue to 19 million to 2030. Will run to 43 million only in renewables in 2050. If we consider the energy efficiency workers and the workers on the infrastructure, this number will go up until 122 million people working in the energy sector. This is double that we have today. And naturally, there will be the shift that has to be accompanied by the right policies. But this, I think, is happening. For example, just to give one example that is not in Asia, but is in Europe. In this new Green Deal, the European Union has provided for just a fund for ensuring the support for everyone that is losing the transition and ensuring that they reach all the other having enjoying the same benefits over the others. It's evident where we are going. So naturally, we have to be close and working with the government as we are doing. For example, we are assessing the socioeconomic footprint of the energy transition for Indonesia, that is a very big country. So yes, we are trying to support the government to make clear how they can navigate in the upcoming period.
I want to talk now about CCUS, carbon capture, utilization and storage, and your take on that. Obviously, IRENA has said that CCUS can be considered for economies which are currently heavily reliant on things like oil, gas, petrochemicals. But would you say that progress on CCUS has been not as fast as we all wish it were? But tell us a little bit more about where you think the potentials are for CCUS for various countries like us in Singapore. Are you optimistic? Are you wanting to see more progress?
First, I think it's important to distinguish between a CCUS and CCS. We are talking about carbon storage, but we are in CCUS, we are talking about utilization. These are not new techniques. If you go just to Wikipedia and see what CCUS, you see that 30 years of technology that is already there. Naturally, progress is still possible from a technological point of view, but it's something that is there already 30 years ago. And we have seen plants of CCUS just closed because they are not economical. The CCUS also, they have some concern concerning the real capacity to abate the CO2. Concerning CCS is different. Naturally, still in a transitional period, CCS could be useful for producing the blue hydrogen. Blue hydrogen will have 30% of all hydrogen be produced in 2050. So there I see the space for a minor presence to electrify, to provide for cleaning the operational of some heavy industries. So these are the area where we see a role for carbon storage. So first of all, not in power, because there is no really option. Imagine today, renewables are already largely more convenient than fossil fuel plants. Now you add also the cost of the storage. So they will become absolutely not economical. It will be very difficult to find a company that will invest in CCS without the support of the government. I think that there is an area where CCS may work, as I told you, for blue hydrogen and enforced in a certain industrial sector. And naturally, we think that, especially in the area that you mentioned, heavily the economy are heavily dependent on fossil fuel, there the CCS will have a more reason to be considered as a possible transitional solution. And concerning the number, we made very, very clear the contribution of CCS in our scenario. And we think the CCS could be, have a hostile role in the biomass and bioenergy because it could be provided for negative emissions. So having a positive net result in terms of reducing CO2 emissions, is what we call the BECCS techniques. So biomass plus CCS.
I'm going to end off our conversation as we look forward to Glasgow at the end of this year, where the Conference of Parties and COP26 is going to meet. Obviously, everyone is looking forward to that. We all hope that it can continue in as wide a physical form as possible. I presume you're going to be there. What is IRENA hoping to do there? And what do you hope parties to COP26 are going to deliver in general and as far as the renewables are concerned?
Naturally, what is important is the country may get to Glasgow with their update NDCs with enhanced ambition. So the first important result from Glasgow that we are expecting is that the country will come with more ambitious targets. And we have already seen that there is more attention to renewables than it was in the past. We have been supported 70 countries in their preparation of the NDC. So first result, raising the ambition. The other aspect that I think is also important that I would like to see, that this will be the kind of COP where we will definitely leave the negotiation attitude of the COP themselves, and we can move to COP that work more on the implementation, on the sharing of experience, understanding the barrier, trying to discuss how we can accelerate the path, having a role also for the private company, for the stakeholders, meeting where we discuss how to do better what we have committed to do. So, and leaving behind this negotiation mood that there is no any more reason for it. We know that there is still something to negotiate on Article 6. But this will be not the dominant point of view team of the COP to look more to how to implement the commitment and the raising of ambition that has been presented to Glasgow.
On that note, Francesco La Camera, thank you very much. And we hope to see you here, perhaps in Singapore very soon.
I have to say that I think that many of these teams will be discussed in the occasion of the Singapore International Energy Week. So
indeed,
I'm looking forward to it. And I hope that the situation will allow me to be present. I've been there in my first year of my tenure. I found an excellent organization, the possibility to go in deep in presenting our analysis, to have insightful discussion. So I really look into it.
I hope to see you here as well then.
Great pleasure. It was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The Climate Conversations. Stay up to date on CNA's coverage of climate change on cna.asia. It's all on the orange tab. You can also find this and other CNA podcasts on our website and on iTunes and Spotify. The team behind this podcast, as always, are Crispina Robert, Lin Su Ling, and Erin Low. I'm Jamie Ho. Till next week.